It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Alex, Renee, and Andy are all here. Lots to talk about. Actually, there's very little to talk about, but we will talk about Apple rumors. Why isn't there a folding iPhone, the next generation MacBook Pro, and also Apple's intent with news? It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 651, recorded Tuesday, March 5th, 2019. Lube for your cube. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV, providing effective training with access to virtual labs and practice tests. Visit go.itpro.tv/MacBreak to take advantage of their lowest prices of the season. For an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription, use the code MacBreak30 at checkout. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again when you can have brilliant, hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi with Eero. Visit Eero.com/MacBreak and get $100 off the Eero base unit, 2 beacons package, and 1 year of Eero Plus when you enter the code MacBreak at checkout. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yep, it's that easy. For an extra 3 months free with a 1 year package, go to ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. With Renee Ritchie from iMore and the Vector Podcast. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Leo. It's smashing to be back with you again this week. Simply
lovely.
Smashing.
Lovely to have you, sir. Andy Anako from Boston Public Radio, WGBH. Hello, Anako.
Hi. Lovely to be here.
Hi.
I try out the single Isaac, not the double Isaac.
Hi. And from the Pixel Core, Mr. Alex Lindsay.
Hello, hello.
It's the full team today. Welcome. Good to have you all here. Google reveals high severity flaw in macOS kernel.
Dum, dum, dum.
Google's Project Zero, which is the security team out there, man, they find stuff everywhere, discovered this more than 90 days ago, told Apple. Apple has not fixed it. So in concert, you know, with the responsible disclosure rules, after 90 days, we're going to tell everybody.
They're like as good as an Eastern European teenage hacker team, it feels like. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, they got this guy Travis, who's really quite good. So it apparently has to do with the copy on write behavior in the OS X kernel. And what's happening is if a user mounted file system, for instance, with disk utility, you mount a file system, is modified, Apple's kernel does not notify the virtual management subsystem that it's been modified. So it's loading stuff into RAM or memory with file mappings, not only with anonymous memory, but after the destination process has started reading from the memory area, due to memory pressure, pages holding the transfer memory can be evicted from the page cache. Okay, we need them back. They load them in, but that file system has been changed, and of course, it's been changed maliciously, still trusted, gets loaded in, and then your troubles begin. So according to Project Zero, if an attacker can mutate an on-disk file without informing the virtual management subsystem, this is a security bug. They informed Apple in November. The company has not fixed it. But according to NeoWin, Apple has accepted the problem. In other words, they're not saying, oh, no, it's not a problem. They said, yeah. And we're working with Project Zero to patch a future release. Now, the reason I bring this up is once that 90 days has passed, it's typical for researchers like Project Zero to put sample code out, and they have. So now, all of a sudden, anybody who's interested can say, oh, this is how you do it. And then it becomes an issue because it's unpatched. Now, I don't know how hard it is to modify and mount a file image, you know, how to get somebody to do that. But my guess is, you know, any malicious software installed on your system could do it, would be my guess. So this is potentially very risky. Is there anything else to say about it except, you know, I don't know.
No, I mean, it's the same. It's the same story with Project Zero. It's that, you know, they're flagging major operating systems like Linux or OS 10 or Mac OS or Windows. And these companies all want to fix this stuff. They have their list of priorities that they go through and they try to fix them as fast as they can. And they'd argue that sometimes they need more time. And Google has set its line in the sand. So we're going to see this from time to time when you know, a vendor simply can't get it done on time. And I have mixed feelings on it. I love the idea that that there is an absolute time limit because it really puts pressure on to fix it. But there are going to be some cases where ginormous vendors just can't get it done in time. And then you risk this being in the wild. And I have heard that they try to negotiate with them and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it seems lately it never does. So, I mean, either you want Google to have a little bit more flexibility or you like the fact that there is an absolute line in the sand. I'm sort of in the middle on it. I think it would be valuable if they would sometimes, if they knew that a thing was coming like, oh, it's 4 days till patch Tuesday, you know, maybe give Microsoft those 4 days. But otherwise, I think it's a good policy.
Yeah, it's not just Google's, by the way. 90 days is kind of standard in the security community. Yeah. The theory is we aren't going to be the only people who find this.
Absolutely.
And so since we found it, it's presumed others might have already found it or that they may find it. So this is responsible disclosure. We're going to tell the company, we're going to give them a chance to fix it. But after a certain period of time, and this is what you debate about, well, what should that period of time be? After a certain period of time, we have to go public with this so that people know of the risk. And that is considered by the security community, 90 days is considered to be the normal amount of time.
There's no way for them to know the complexity because like some things might be trivial, almost trivial for the company to fix. And some things,
that's true.
Not even intuitively, might be a nightmare because it creates a cast. Like all this stuff for 10 years has been built on this bug. And now it fixed, like there was a famous Safari bug where they fixed that bug and it broke literally almost everything else because everyone had assumed that bug was normal behavior. And there's no way for a company like Google to know that.
And there have been many cases where companies have just said, nah, we're not going to fix it. And that's when responsible disclosure really does mandate, well, we got to tell people. But there maybe should be some leeway for a company that's like, in this case, Apple says, oh, gosh, yeah, we're working on it. And then give us a little more time because this is a complicated fix. Andy, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, just my only comment was that there is such a thing as the trust chain where at some point people have to understand, even if there's no fix, that they probably shouldn't trust this element of an operating system or this element of a system. I mean, this story reminded me of the story about the Apollo moon landings, where if they successfully landed on the moon and now they're zipping up like the last part of the EVA suit, like it's just a zippered overcoat, doesn't hold anything in, it's just like a protective overcoat, and the tab on the zipper breaks off, they have to assume that the entire suit is compromised, because if this thing is broken, what else could be broken in this suit? Which means that now you can't have two people doing an EVA, which means that you can't have a single person doing EVA on their own, which means that because of this one little tab, because of the disastrous consequences, if something goes wrong with this operation, that means that suddenly the entire EVA is scrapped, assuming that the astronaut does not on his own fail to tell mission control that what has happened and decides to fix it with a paperclip. So that's the sort of thing that we're talking about, where at some point there's value in simply knowing that, by the way, if you're assuming that this part of this system is secure, do not make that assumption. But you're absolutely right in that if one person has found it, it's not necessarily true that other people have. No one has said that they've seen any sort of an exploit for this out in the field, which would have been a totally different thing to worry about. But that means that we could worry about, for instance, a government knowing about this and not wanting to tell anybody about it. It is a complex argument, but at some point, if your SEAL Team 6 version of security team, if you decide that your job is to make everything safer and more secure, then the ability of Apple to fix this within 90 days is their problem and not yours. Your responsibility, as you choose to define it, is to make sure that people know that something is safe or something is not safe.
Yeah. I hate to be completely inflexible, but you know, so
yeah, I mean, it's complicated, but I certainly see their point of view.
Yeah, and somebody asked, well, does Google ever, Project Zero ever report on Google flaws? Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was originally created, in fact, for Google to police its own security issues. But these guys are so good. Travis Kalanick
has found so many significant flaws. If you ever listen to Security Now, you'll hear his name come up all the time. And many of the flaws he comes up with are devious as heck. This is fairly devious. It's easy. This is not like the group FaceTime flaw. This is something that you got some, you know, this would be hard to detect ahead of time.
So. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I had to read the story and other people and analyze the story before I even felt as though I begin to understand what the hell is going on with this. Yeah. And that's why we have experts in security.
Absolutely.
Doing nothing but focusing on this.
I didn't do justice to it, but the idea is, you know, kind of a broader brush is you're loading in something, you assume it's safe, and then a bad guy changes it and there's no notification it's been changed, and you continue to load it and it turns out now it's not safe. And that it would be, you know, that's a hard thing to find. And remember,
you order your drive-through, and then they replace the guy behind the window after you pay, but before you get your food.
Yeah, with the evil Savonarola yes. who is putting arsenic in it. You know, you go, oh, no. There, that's good. That's an analogy.
I just want my burger, and you don't think about it.
And remember, they don't have Apple's source code, I don't think. So they're doing this, you know, kind of reverse engineering everything. Well, I bet you Steve Gibson will talk about it later on Security Now. Mm. And as long as we're talking about flaws, we might as well stay in that. A researcher, we talked about this, I think, about a month ago, Linus Hensa, said he found a Mac OS keychain security hole, and he wasn't going to tell Apple because he was mad that his work would go unpaid. You know, there's no bug bounty for this. You know, there's a bug bounty for iOS, but apparently not for Mac OS. So he said, well, I'm not going to tell you. Well, Apple apparently approached him and said, look, let's talk. Let's figure it out. And I guess they have at least worked it out to the point that he's sharing details with Apple, but not yet promised any money for it. Apple's always been...
They are working on it. They are working on the Mac bounty program. I don't know why they haven't announced it yet. It's been ridiculously long since they announced the iOS one, and as far as I know, they've been working on the Mac one since they announced the iOS one. So it's beyond weird.
I kind of understood Apple's position that if we start paying people to find bugs, it just inflates the value because then we're bidding against national nation states.
But they pay low. It's like a good Samaritan fee, basically.
You got to do
low
it because
no one's bidding.
But paying bounties in this current culture is what will make the system more secure, because there are companies that make money off of security flaws that are paying lots and lots of money for these things. So if they don't want people to find a bug and then say, I can either get nothing by reporting this to Apple, or I could get $150,000 by reporting it to this company that's a security company whose job is penetrating phones and penetrating systems at the bidding of private individuals and foreign governments, if they don't want that to happen, they're going to have to at least put some skin in the game. They don't have to necessarily top the highest bid, but there are people that spent weeks, months developing this who don't see it as anything else than I can either have a Tesla or I can continue to driving my old Prius. Which do I want, depending on what I do with this work that I've done?
And I think a lot of them just need something that they consider fair. I don't think you need to necessarily compete with nation states. But I think that, I mean, if you are competing, you can't.
You can't.
But I think that, but if you said, we're going to pay $25,000 or $50,000 or whatever for it, you know, because the other thing is what you want is a handful of people who are really smart to spend their whole day thinking about it.
Yeah.
And working on it. And if they can make $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year figuring out, you know, saving you millions in possible losses, it's worth it.
Yeah. I love this story. A 19-year-old Argentinian, he taught himself online from online courses, had a program. He is the first millionaire through HackerOne bug bounties. He has made $1 million in bug bounties.
That's awesome.
Isn't that great? And he's a kid, and he's a self-taught kid. He didn't go to college. He didn't have the money to do it. He just kind of fell in love with technology.
He does now. Maybe he can go back to college now.
Yeah, now. He was inspired, oddly enough, by the 1995 film Hackers, which only inspired me to nausea, but apparently...
I wish I'd been Sneakers.
Sneakers, at least, right? He learned to hack by watching free online tutorials and reading blogs. He got his first bug bounty when he was 16. And he chose the Twitter handle try_2_hack to keep himself motivated. He's been hacking after school. He now does it full time and earns 40 times the average software engineer salary in Buenos Aires. I love it.
So one of the, like, I know there are some people who really dislike the idea of the bounty programs. The way I try to look at it is this: you have good Samaritans who will just stumble across bugs like the FaceTime bug, you know, and give you back your wallet. And then maybe you'll give them a few bucks because it's nice, you know, to reward good Samaritan activities. You have your police, which are like the red teams at the various companies that respond. They find their own bugs. They respond to them. They seek out the offenders. And then it's, but it's also good to have these, like, these people out there who are just looking for them, like consultants, like experts who you'll, like, you know, they know that you will compensate them if they, if you bring them good work. And it's not like they're going to sell it to the mob if you don't give them something, but it's just, it's better to have a wide and diverse network of people out there. It's better for everybody in the end.
Hacker One has actually become, made a business out of this. They've got tutorials and online videos to teach you how to do fuzzing and look other techniques. And they have handed out now $19 million in bug bounties. $19
million. $1 million to that one guy.
$1 million to that one guy. But there are many, many hackers who are actually now making a living. And this is, of course, highlighting the problem of the word hackers, which implies a bad guy. But it doesn't. It isn't, in fact. It's just somebody who likes to hack on code. And many hackers are not bad guys. So they
are. Or girls. Or women.
Or women. Yeah, absolutely. Should say that. Yep. In fact, software engineers, you might be interested to hear this. This is kind of a sea change in Apple. Apple is now hiring more software engineers than hardware engineers.
I'm kind of surprised that that just happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This comes from a data-driven site called ThinkNum. Software and services job listings have outnumbered hardware engineering listings since the third quarter of last year. So, but this is the new Apple.
Yeah. Again, electrons are a lot easier to manipulate and distribute than molecules. So that's where the future of the company is going.
And also, once you build the molecules, there's just a lot of different things you want to do with the electrons.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We didn't mention this,
not the atoms,
last week, but the one division you don't want to work for at Apple is the self-driving car. They've laid off a big chunk of employees last week.
It's hard to know whether that's related to them scaling down or just changing direction.
You
know,
in fact, Apple says it's a reorg.
It's a change of direction, yeah. But they also, I don't know if it technically can be called a layoff because those people are being put into other orgs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And also remember that a lot of the research that they're doing in self-driving cars is so applicable in things like augmented reality. You're talking about a thing that is moving throughout real space and being able to, having to analyze visual input on a very, very quick basis and then make decisions based on that. That is something that if you were able to build a pair of goggles, you would be able to put that software very, very nicely into a pair of goggles. So
I should point out that these are actual layoffs, that I'm sure there are many hundreds of other people who will be moved from the division to another division. But Apple filed this with the California Employment Development Department saying by April we will be firing 38 engineering program managers, 33 hardware engineers, 31 project and design engineers, and 22 software engineers on April 16th. Yeah, you have to file that if you're going to do a layoff.
And I don't know if we know what what that percentage is of the team either.
We don't. And nor do we know how many other hundreds have been moved to different divisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah. And remember that. Sorry.
I mean, layoffs are, for most of these companies, is a house cleaning project.
It's a fraction.
Well, yeah. It's a house cleaning project as well. I mean, you find that there's a lot of people that you hired that didn't really turn out.
Right.
Letting go each one of them on their own is a legal liability, whereas laying off a bunch of them is something that you can do as a, well, we're making a reorg and we're just
That's why
it.
You file this.
Yeah. And also remember when this story first broke, I think from the Wall Street Journal, they had a lot of details about people who had been hired specifically from the automotive industry. So they have people who, I guess, you know, how to make suspensions and how to do the ECR boxes, things that are very, very automotive specific that maybe are not necessarily important now if Apple has decided that they'd much rather build software for other companies' cars, or if they've decided that the technology they've developed is more for fleet operations than for personal vehicles. So as usual, given that Apple hasn't really, given that we have no idea exactly what was inside that part of the company, it's hard to speculate. But yeah, that is new. I thought that the last time that they meant that was in the news, they were specifically saying that they're more moving engineers from one division to another division, but this time if they're saying that they're layoffs, that's
my understanding, and it is the way the companies work. And I've heard this from both Apple and Google, and it might just be a Silicon Valley thing, is that you're given your notice, and then you have certain number of weeks to find another group that's willing to take you on. And if that group takes you on, then nothing like you just basically move groups. And if it doesn't, then you're technically out of the company and you can reapply for another position.
Yeah, I'm sure that they do that. I'm sure they give them a chance to look at other listings within the company. Yeah, and perhaps give them a head start.
Yeah. We also have no idea how many people are working on Apple projects that are actually employed by contractors that Apple does not have to file paperwork for. So
right. Well, you know, we're just reading the tea leaves. That's all we do here. Apple doesn't tell us anything.
Criminology.
We just have to read the tea leaves. Let's take a little break. Come back with more, including USB 4. Get ready.
Ooh.
Just when you thought it was fun. Safe to get a USB cord. USB 4. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. I feel like a certain affinity for these guys. I first met Tim and Don at NAB, at the NAB conference, where we did a panel on IPTV and, using the internet for as we do for content. And I think Tim and Don were kind of inspired. They were, at the time, IT trainers in a traditional setting with a classroom and, you teach people. The reason you have these, of course, is because if you want to get into the IT business, often even a degree isn't what you need. What you need are certifications that say, yes, Leo knows this, Leo knows that. You're an MCSE or you're a ISC squared. You have an A+ certificate or you have a certified ethical hacker certificate. Those are the things to get that first job that are very valuable, often a requisite for getting the job. And so they were doing great doing that, but they saw what we were doing with TWiT, and a light bulb went off, and Tim Broom and Dom Pezet started IT Pro TV. And the whole idea there is, they've got 5 studios now, by the way, they've completely surpassed us, is to do the same kind of engaging, fun content, including chat rooms and on-the-air quizzes and stuff, but to do it for IT training. And what a success it has been. They started advertising with us very early on, and I have to say, I've watched them soar. They really are doing great. IT Pro TV has the best trainers, experts in the field. A lot of IT teams use IT Pro TV for their teams, not to give them certs necessarily, but to keep their skills up. 4,000 hours of on-demand training at IT Pro TV. And now you can see the members of the team growing 100,000 plus. They just crossed 100,000 plus IT Pro TV learners. It is a massive success. And partly because it is the most affordable, most engaging way to learn the skills you need. A standard membership is $28.50. I'm going to tell you, I can make it a lot more affordable, but $28.50 a month. Premium membership, which includes not just the classes, but also labs where you don't even have to have a Windows machine to be able to actually set up Windows servers and configure clients. And practice exams, too. So if you're getting ready for those IT certs, that's great. The premium membership is $42 a month. But right now, I'm happy to say IT Pro TV is still honoring the special offer we've had since they started with us, 30% off for TWiT listeners. And that is not just for a week or a month or a year. That's forever, as long as you stay active. That means that the standard membership is under $20 a month. You are not going to find this kind of training anywhere for that price. Or $200 a year. The premium membership now, just $29.50 a month, or $295 a year. This is cheaper even than just buying the books to do the studying. And it's so much more fun. You can watch on the big screen TV. They have iOS and Android apps, but they support Chromecast. They have a Roku app, an Amazon Fire TV app, really nice Apple TV app. Of course, you can watch streaming on your PC too. So, you can have it on the big screen while you're eating breakfast, hop in the car, listen on the way in, keep it as a picture-in-picture on your screen during work. imagine how quickly you will learn the skills you need. Episodes are recorded live every day, Monday through Friday, in their five studios. They go from studio to web in 24 hours, so they always have the freshest training. By the way, it's kind of cool. CompTIA now uses IT Pro TV as their official video training partner. That means they've got 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. They've got the CompTIA A+, Network Plus, and Security Plus certs. So they're just going great guns. I want you to visit them right now. go.itpro.tv/MacBreak. Get started with your standard or premium membership. This is the time to get that job in IT you've always wanted, or to keep your job or get a better job with the training from IT Pro TV. go.itpro.tv/MacBreak. And if you want that 30% off, don't forget to use the offer code MacBreak30 at checkout. MacBreak30. IT Pro TV is flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. And I'm very proud of the success that they have achieved. USB 4.0. You know, I bring this up on MacBreak Weekly because we wouldn't probably have USB if Steve Jobs with the iMac, the very first iMacs, hadn't said, and we're going to support USB. I mean, that was a big part of it. We're not going to build a floppy.
Some weird Apple connector.
Yeah, we're going to support it.
And then suddenly we had to figure out how to get all our ADB keys to work.
this comes on the heels of them saying that USB 2 and 3 are all USB 3.1 and 3.2 now. And
well, that's a little confusing. In fact, thank goodness iMore has written a fabulous article, Jerry Hildenbrand, everything you need to know about USB 4, better, stronger, faster, backward compatible, 40 gigabits per second, so it competes with Thunderbolt 3. In fact,
it is Thunderbolt 3.
It basically carries Thunderbolt 3, right?
Yeah.
It's two-lane operation.
USB 4 carries Thunderbolt 3.
But you can use your Type-C cables. That's very good news. So is it Thunderbolt 3? I mean, are they just renaming Thunderbolt? No, it's got to be more than that, right?
Yeah, it's a super. I think it's a superset of Thunderbolt 3.
Okay. But it is compatible with.
And if people are panicking, the numbers are the protocol, the bits that go over the wire. The letters are the plug type. So no one is taking your USB-C cable, the one that you just finally got everyone to convert to, and making you get an L-shaped cable or anything. Yeah. It's the same ending as Thunderbolt 3 and USB-C cables already.
Yeah.
Hallelujah. Yeah, it just recently we got USB 3.2. So now we have to say we've got USB 3.2 extended to USB 4 over USB-C, at which point your friend's head
explodes.
Compatible
with TB3.
Yes. Will there be at some point just this merging of standards so everything's Type-C?
The problem is that Thunderbolt is an Intel thing, and Intel, as we know, it has not had the greatest success bringing things to market recently. So everyone is still waiting on PCI. It's my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this stuff, but my understanding is we have Thunderbolt 3 now, and it's an Intel thing, and we're waiting on PCIe 4 so we can have Thunderbolt 4, but it's taking a while. And meanwhile, USB is doing its thing. And luckily, but confusingly, a lot of cables can carry both.
And apparently Intel has dropped the royalty or has somehow made it more open. Thunderbolt 3, it's open and royalty free. So that probably has a lot to do with it as well.
Because who wants royalty-based connectors? I mean, there's the last thing. You want something to be ubiquitous, make it open. Feels like common sense.
Hey, speaking of iMore, I didn't mention this, but I gather... Well, you tell me. Congratulations are in order. iMore was acquired by Future.
Yes. Yeah. So if people aren't familiar with Future, they have T3 and TechRadar and a bunch of paper publications, because in Europe, that still makes a lot of sense. In America, they recently, I forget how long ago, a year ago, bought Perch, which had a Nantech and Tom's Guide and Tom's Hardware and Laptop Magazine. And so in order to increase, I guess, their North American scope, they bought Mobile Nations, which was a proprietor. It was started by Marcus Adelson back in the days of Visor Central, and he kept it all these years. I guess he finally decided it was better to be bigger. So he and his partners sold to Future, and now we're all one big happy family.
Is it going to change anything from your point of view?
We're running completely as Mobile Nations for at least a year, because as far as I know, they're still busy with doing all their stuff. So it's not going to change anything for now. And if you look at Nantech and Tom's Guide and Tom's Hardware, they've been with Future for a year, and I can't see anything that's changed.
They've gotten better, if anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So hopefully, I mean, you know, it's new people, so I can never say never. But as far as I can tell, nothing has changed with any of their properties.
Probably
so
the best known future property, one of their earliest, is Maximum PC Magazine. I think a lot of people are familiar with
Mac
that.
Mac Life, maybe what people
did,
remember.
Did they do 3D World?
Long time remember. Ago, they do a Guitar Player Magazine.
Yeah, 3D World. There it is.
They're smart to kind of go digital, and a lot of their properties are 100% digital.
Yeah.
A lot of photo stuff, digital photographer, photography.
Guitar stuff. It's a huge range.
Yeah. This reminds me a lot of the old Ziff Davis, where they were originally like sailing magazines and all sorts of other stuff too, all these specialty magazines. But I don't know what the future for magazines is, so it's smart of them. Anyway, I just thought you're the news this week.
Thank you.
I thought I'd mention it.
This is going to be like Marvel movies, where now the Spider-Man movie has to involve Tony Stark somehow, because you have to make sure that you promote the next movie.
Well, I did ask Ryan from Inantech if he was going to benchmark me. He said no, but he is going to overclock me, and I don't think anybody is looking forward to that.
Yeah. It looks like they even do conferences, right? They're going to do the video show.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
When and where is the video show?
At the NEC in 2019, everything the budding filmmaker, professional videographer, vlogger, or online content creator needs to expand their moving image production horizons. I'm not familiar with the NEC. It's probably something British. But that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think who is it that bought VidCon and... Is it Viacom? One of the big, I think it was Viacom bought VidCon. VidCon is the big YouTube conference. And so there's clearly a consolidation.
NEC Birmingham.
It's in Birmingham, Alabama?
No, Birmingham.
Oh, England.
the original Birmingham.
Oh, the one with the smokestacks. Yeah, I know that. Viacom has been acquiring a lot of these digital properties as well.
But I will say congratulations to the Mobile Nation's owners, because in an era of rapidly self-destructing media companies, they managed to build a really, really good business out of hard work and creator.
Are they now out of it? I mean, are they gone?
No, they're staying on. They're staying on. Oh, the same management team, everything.
Good. So your life won't change dramatically.
Nope. Crackberry Kevin is still my boss.
And Vector and all that will continue on as well.
Yep.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because we count on Vector. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's actually kind of Apple's kind of part of that story. I mean, really is a changing world. We know that, or we think that, according to John Patchkowski, and I think Mark Gurman confirmed, Apple's going to have a news announcement later this month, maybe the 25th, although that's a Monday. So we think that's odd. Negotiations continue with publishers, and Digiday had an article this week about publishers who are already on Apple News, and probably some of the texture publishers are also there as well, who are reporting that ad revenue is not great.
This should be an Aaron Sorkin show, shouldn't it? I'd love to see all the behind the scenes on this stuff.
Yeah.
Again,
according to Digiday, ad revenue is bogged down by advertisers' disinterest in the ad inventory publishers are selling directly. And so in some cases, one source said their publication earned low five figures every month from Apple News. Another said they earned less than $1,000 a month.
The biggest success, which is not good news for Apple, is the publishers that aren't full on Apple News, but Apple's throwing, like, especially now with political news, entertainment news, Apple is throwing so much traffic their way. When you look at the numbers of referrals they're getting from Apple, it's ridiculous. And then it hits your subscriber, and it hits their own paywall, or it hits their own ad pile. And, you know, that's not great for subscribers who are going all in on Apple News, and it's not great for Apple News. So they're going to have to fix that, or everything is going to be finish reading this article on the web.
I mean, with CPMs as low as $3 and $4,
that's what it's like in YouTube too. For video.
Yeah, or radio.
Digital ads in general are horrible, and declining.
Yeah. So I don't. That might make it.
Ads that Apple's terrible at doing. Well, according to the publishers, Apple's really bad at filling remnant stock or filling, like, you'll get like the one display ad. And if people aren't sure how this works, generally you'll have like the premium ads, and those are the ones that pay the best, but they have a number of times that they'll display, and then it's got to show something else because you're no longer getting paid for that ad. So most publishers have a stack of different ads, like, it's have the real big premium ones.
It's called remnant. Renman inventory.
Yeah, and then either like Google, I think Google with Ad Exchange is one of the
in
biggest
case,
ones. I forget
it's NBC Universal that's apparently selling the Renman.
But those Renman ads are generally the horrible ads that you see on the website, and Apple isn't filling those. And so there's nothing. Any of those ads are horrible, people click on them, and that generates revenue. So it's,
Or they at least see them, right? I mean, you know, I always think it's funny. I know whatever page I just went to when I go to speedtest.net, because I get five ads that are all the same.
So the same thing.
You know, all about whatever. B&H. You know, it's usually all my B&H orders because I went to B&H first for something. Osmo Pocket.
So the point of this article, though, in fact, the headline is, it's hard to back out. Even if you're not making the money you wanted, you can't back out either.
Yeah, because I mean, the thing is, they also need flow. I mean, everyone was talking about how Spotify and all these subscription services were ruining the music business, and now it's the majority of their income. In fact, their income is starting to go up. You know, as people start to move and use these platforms, I think that they're going to find that they're making more money. But in the transition, sure, it doesn't make any sense. Until enough people are doing it, until enough average folks are using it, it isn't going to make sense revenue. It's not the thing that you can lean on yet. But streaming music has definitely gotten to a point where they can lean on it.
Yeah.
But each one of these types of media is unique, however. And Apple has to make sure that they're providing a product that the people who are buying this are going to be able to use. It's not just Apple tends to ask for a lot of control over any kind of service that they tie into. And sometimes with advertising in particular, the things that I'm hearing about from major publishers is largely that I need the information that I can get about my readership. I need to know what people are reading on my own site and what kind of level of engagement there is. And they're not confident that they're going to get that sort of stuff off of Apple. And so if Apple is negotiating from the position of, we are an elite brand, we are making you look so good, you should be so happy that we're associated with us, that's not going to pay out in the future. They dallied with advertising earlier on. That's the reason why we don't really think of Apple as an advertising company, because they just didn't create a product that was useful to the marketplace.
I mean, the pattern for all these publishers, though, that's dangerous is that, you know, the Hollywood decided they were going to stonewall Netflix, and that has not turned out well for them. Everyone's afraid that Spotify and Apple will eventually just cut the publishers out because they can. And eventually, you know, like if you look at Future, which just bought iMore, what if Apple says, okay, I give up and we'll start buying these guys, and filling the, you know, and then Apple News becomes a whole lot of things that they can provide that have all these verticals. The problem for, if they decided that they were going to do that, the problem for publishers is that, okay, now I have this thing that works and it's totally tied in. Or I can try to survive outside of that ecosystem. So them pushing back too hard just will lead these tech companies to decide they need to do it themselves.
It's weird too because we got like kind of hooked on the metrics, because in the old days, you know, you bought the newspaper, you bought the magazine, and their demographic business was as big as their classified business. They lived on all the addresses and information they had because they could sell those for huge marketing revenue. But they also knew that every magazine and newspaper they sold were probably read by two people, the magazine in the dentist office by like 30 people. And they sort of padded the numbers to account for that. And now we're seeing a digital equivalent of that, where the article is going out to Apple, but then being read by a billion people. And there's no real way to pad had for that.
I think that the thing is that they do need to find a way to, I don't think that Apple needs to give them the information to be able to give them data and data of how many people are watching a certain article, or being able to even notify the users. If the users are, if it's basically a publishing, like an RSS system where Apple's, you know, a publisher says, I've got a new article, and your app on your phone is securely asking for, are there new articles from the New York Times? Apple doesn't have to connect the two of you together to give them some of what they need, you know, for that process. They can anonymize it and then allow it to, you know, that information to kind of go back and forth without breaking that up, much like Apple Pay, doesn't really give anybody a lot of information either. And
they
so,
have the number, they just don't know how.
Yeah, and
who
so
it is.
And so the thing is that, but there's a lot of data that you can get. When I'm trying to figure out, you know, I know a little bit of the publishing, but in video, we definitely want to have a lot of information, and we get that. I don't know anything about the actual users that are on the other side, but I know how many people were watching at a certain time. I know when they left, when they entered. I can, if I cross that against other marketing processes, I start to get a lot of information about what is actually happening, you know, on my video, and I make decisions about what part of videos are good and which parts we should do less of. So it's a lot of the information that they need. Now, they'll say that they want those demographics because they want to resell those demographics. I mean, they want those email lists, and they want that stuff because a big part of their business is, you know, reselling the list, which they're not getting from Apple, and they're not going to get from Apple. And so that's obviously going to be frustrating. And I think that they find that if they can back channel a bunch of complaints, they can try to pressure Apple to do it, which is why we're seeing this article, of course. And but I don't think that they're going to get the data.
I wanted to format this comment in a way that doesn't turn into another 30 minutes. But what I think one of the bigger problems is that a lot of what I've been hearing both in public and in private about Apple's upcoming offering is that it's very, very it leans very, very heavily towards national news. And so much of what we consider news is very, very local or very, very specific. And so it's not going to be very, very helpful to have this sort of thing. Nonetheless, if I'm going to be opening up an app that's called News, I do want to know about what certain people in the federal government have been testifying against each other on. But I also want to know that there was a pack of coyotes spotted in my town last night, and that perhaps that's a good time to like make sure that the cats don't get to go outside last night. But even like local sports, even local politics, even local news, things are not really interesting to a national audience. I like the fact that when I go to news.google.com, there is an actual pane for here is like that's where I found out that there was a pack of coyotes in my town. But I don't have cats, but still, that's an interesting thing to know. You have to be able to make sure that your service is going to be of use to the person who's actually going to be reading it. And so that means that the fact that you know exactly what kind of halter top a Kardashian was photographed in yesterday, that's not of much interest to me, but I really want to know if the proposal to basically replace the entire sewer system in my part of town is going through or not. I want to know about that because it affects where I'm going to be able to park cars in 4 months.
Well, I wonder if it's going to be a news organization. Like for me, all of my information about my local community is from Nextdoor, you know, and I get my little notifications all the time. Sometimes too many notifications, but Nextdoor is. Oddly enough, there was a long discussion recently about the coyotes in the back of the behind the houses and the fact that they were eating the turkeys, or people wanted them to eat the turkeys because there are a lot of turkeys here, too. And but all of my information that I know about whether 37 was closed, whether there's rain, the police the reports are often put up there, the local meetings, like all the things that I would normally get from a newspaper. I feel like I get the parts that I really care about on that one website. And so the question is, is that publishing, does it all make sense, or is it viable in a place where I didn't even know what Nextdoor was until like 6 months ago. And then as soon as I said it, I found this thing called Nextdoor, and everyone was like, yeah, yeah. My wife was like, yeah, I've been on that for the last 3 years. Yeah. 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 It's kind of like how we figure this out, you know? And I think that what's interesting about it is that I think that the problem really for publishers is going to be the monodirectional function of their system, which is that they're not going back and forth. What makes Nextdoor really interesting is that we're all discussing stuff all the time. You know, recently we've been discussing leashed dogs, but there's, you know, you're discussing stuff back and forth, and the future of media, I think, is going to be a discussion, not a monodirectional broadcast of text. Video, audio, whatever. It's all going to be back and forth. And these publishers aren't ready for that. They don't understand that at all.
Well, it's
complete, I'm in the meetings with them.
It's complete. complete change from what they do, which is stories.
It requires a completely different set of talents, a completely different set of reporters, a completely different, like there's a, it is like a complete That's truly is a paradigm shift.
They don't want to change it.
Yeah, it's terrifying for them. Yeah. It's going to be a very hard transition. It's not going to be something that's easy.
I've been thinking about this in the context of the Spotify acquisition of Gimlet and Anchor and their goals with podcasting. And I think is that some people think of podcasts, and Gimlet certainly does, as kind of like TV shows. You make shows. Yeah. They have seasons. They run for a period of time. The hosts aren't as important as the production values and the content, the stories they're telling. And honestly, that's not what we do, and it's not what I believe in. So this is the same thing where if you have that Hollywood mindset that we tell stories, you know, we make movie. You make a movie, we get everybody together, they make a movie, then they go away. And now we're going to make another movie. Then that's what you do with podcasting. And I think that's exactly the wrong thing to me. And maybe it's my background in radio. I think, and it's certainly been the case for us, podcasting is not about the content as much as the conversation, as you said, about the people who are making, the hosts are far more important. It's a, you know, we're not in show business. We're in people business, and it is about conversation.
And there's an authentic conversation among people who actually know what they're talking about.
And if you want longevity, you know, this show's 15 years old. If you want something to go on and on and on, it's going to be about the people. Of course, the content has to be something you're interested in. If you're interested in Max, then this would be, or Apple, this would be an interesting show for you. But if you don't like the people, you're going to move on.
Right.
And if you don't like the conversation. And and I think that that's a, you know, it was said in the earliest days of the internet, people interpret the internet based on their bias, what they came from. You know, if you're a magazine publisher, you thought, oh, great way to publish magazines.
Well, and
if you're a video maker, it's, oh, a great way to publish videos.
Yeah. And we find that a lot of, you know, that we've had the opportunity to do 2,000 shows in the last, you know, 10 years, you know, for other people. And you watch this wide range of you, when you work, anytime you work with someone in New York or Hollywood, you end up with this jam packed show that has, we've got bumpers and sweepers and things, and then we're going to play out. We're going to do a play out, and then we're going to come back.
Right.
And it's so tight that there's no authentic communication,
right.
You know, and what we found,
one person on stage is much more effective than a jazzy produced.
Well, thing. And when you start actually letting the audience, you know, because we have an IRC
part.
And we did a,
we don't do, that was always a challenge for me. One of the reasons we do shows live is because we want to make them interactive. Most people don't listen live though. So it's a really interesting challenge for, it always has been for us. You know, I come from talk radio, which is fully interactive.
Right. Well, and then, you know, it's one of those things. It's a chicken or egg kind of thing. When people know that you're going to have that, more and more people show up for the stuff that's live too. You know, it's a matter of audience.
Yeah, we thought that would happen.
Well, it's the hard.
It didn't.
the
because people have lives. That's the other side of it.
Right.
Yeah. You know? What? How dare they?
But I, you know, I always liked live radio because it's live and you can call. If you got something, you call in and actually, most people never call a radio show, but you feel like it's a conversation by proxy because,
and you feel like you could call in. You know, and that's the, you know, it's like the lottery.
Right.
You know, it's like you could win if you actually played. So,
let's see. Other Apple news. Apparently, Apple, according to iFixit, Apple has started putting longer cables in their MacBook Pros. They never admitted that there were issues, but many had said, you know, these MacBook Pros fail after repeated opening and closing of the laptop. And in fact, it was dubbed FlexGate because of the flex display cables. Apple never said, oh, yeah, there's a problem. But iFixit notices the latest MacBook Pros have a longer cable.
Yeah, well, that was so embarrassing. It seemed to be a very, very simple engineering failure, but also the fact that they decided to integrate this cable with the display itself meant that if someone came in with this problem, they said, okay, well, it's no
new
problem.
New screen
with this,
for you.
Exactly. $600. Bucks. Thank you very much.
Yep. This is, if you've never seen it, and I actually have never seen it, but I probably don't open my laptop enough, but this is what the failure starts as. They call it the stage light effect, where you've got these kind of footlights coming up from the bottom of your screen.
It's very theatrical.
Once you see that, you know that your cable is failing, and it's going to be a $700 replacement because they're not going to, as Andy says, they can't just fix the flex.
Wah.
You have to fix the whole screen.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say dumpster fire in context with this design.
Not that bad.
There's smoke. There's reason for take a look and see.
Well, and this is, you know, honestly, every year you got to do something to improve your product, and sometimes it's something invisible like a slightly or longer cable.
Something to keep a $2,000 laptop from failing.
Yeah, right. Anyway, just an update if you've had this problem.
Weird to me that, like, again, like I was talking about this with Gruber last week, that, you know, back in the day, Steve Jobs would run downstairs, throw the thing at somebody's head and say, why doesn't it work the way it should?
Right.
And 7 months later, it'd be fixed. And we're going on like 4 years with this laptop. And like, again, regardless of whether you like or dislike the design, the keyboard, anything, we can all agree that it has the most divisive and most unhappy making MacBook in memory. And it's going on.
Have you ever had your screen fail?
No,
I have.
Have you?
But not this way. But there was another.
I mean, I've had other laptops fail that way. I mean, I think that's a very common failure. The difference is, as Andy pointed out, other laptops, they swap out a cable.
Yeah. Yeah. I had there was a 2012 problem that was same. It was a different issue, but it was the same thing where when you went to the Apple store, they were like, yeah, they all broke. You know, like they like it's just a certain amount of, there was a certain amount of time and you just use it a certain period of time and it just die. And of course it was with my luck, it was more than 3 years after I bought it. So,
I'm glad Apple learned this lesson and they're fixing it. And I wonder if there are going to be new MacBook Pros. Of course, we mentioned that, the rumor is there'll be a 16-inch.
I want a 22-inch.
22.
Amazing. Yeah, just throw it in a big.
How big is yours? Your computer there, Leo? 30 inches.
This is 30. Yeah. This is the 30-inch iPad that I'm using.
30 is too much.
Alex 22. Just wants to. Alex just wants to wear a MacBook like on his back, like Captain America's shield.
I have to say, we still miss the 17. The 17 was a great.
Oh, that was nuts.
It was
will be a 17 in a 15-inch
and
chassis.
Exactly. The GPU.
Yeah.
And if the 16-inch has the same screen size as the 17, it'll be great. The GPU on the 17-inch GPU is still better than most MacBooks.
So it was NVIDIA, right?
What?
Wasn't it NVIDIA still back then?
NVIDIA chip, and it is still better than the crap that comes in the MacBooks now.
It is a great idea, given how on point all of Apple's pro-level Mac hardware tends to be, with one exception in my opinion. But imagine them making a 17-inch style MacBook that says pro people that just need something that they can put in a hard case, deploy when they get to the venue, and have really a full screaming demon setup with no compromises. Yeah. We didn't decide to delete something because of thinness. We didn't decide to change something because, gosh, this thing needs to have a 12-hour battery life. Imagine how good a MacBook could be if they simply decided the performance and if they simply decided this is more of a portable solution than a mobile solution, so to speak.
So I have been known to walk by and say iMacBook Pro until the point where people want to shove me.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to keep saying that until they actually want to shove it out.
MacBook Pro.
I just I still think the market.
It's an iMac Pro that you can unfold and take with you.
Yeah. Oh.
I think my problem is, as a pro who would definitely want one of those laptops and would be so happy if I had one, I just know I've limited my expectations. The market's not big enough to make that work.
But you see, like, Marquez travels with his iMac Pro in a Pelican case because he can't render fast enough on a MacBook Pro.
I see people at the Starbucks with their iMac. I'm like, really? You like brought your iMac? I'm not kidding. Like every day,
I go there. Carry on, right? People like piles up leather carrying pouch.
I don't even take my laptop to the Starbucks anymore. I take my iPad. It's like the laptop's like, oh, I'm pulling out.
How
the
much
tank.
Faster?
Take your Surface.
If you had a top of the line MacBook Pro, the i9, and maybe even an eGPU, wouldn't that be as fast as an iMac Pro, or maybe not?
Well, he said he's got the 18 core with like the giant GPU in it. So yeah, he's still doing it in hours instead of overnight.
So he's carrying around in a Pelican case a $15,000 computer.
Shh. He's not taking it to Starbucks, though. I mean, it's just...
No,
we used to have laptops like that. I mean...
Leo takes his Surface to Starbucks. Look at him.
Yeah.
So comfortable.
Very happy.
Well, there's a lot of room for different interpretations. At CES, I've been trying to remember who manufactured it, but some company that's known for like really high-performance gaming machines had It was a very large screen. It seemed like a 17-inch or 20-inch display. And it was, again, not designed necessarily for mobility, but for portability. And it had like a Microsoft Surface-style sort of flap on the back so that obviously it's not designed for like multiple sort of positions, but it meant that instead of having like an iMac-style built-in stand that would never fold flat, this thing, when you fold it down, could actually become a self-contained package, including a stand and protection for the keyboard, so that if you were to zip it inside like a folio case or something, and this is something you could easily take on board an airplane.
And there's some great
I'm not saying that anybody should do that, but it's an interesting way to address a section of the market that wants a desktop that they can easily take from job to job to job.
And there's some great customization. You can take that arm off the back. And just the nub.
It's a
and
Visa mount there, right?
It's not a Visa. It's not. I don't know if it's a Visa mount, but it's
on the iMac. It is.
Yeah, and so anyway, you can take that off, and then you can do all kinds of things with it. And there's some great arms and great customization that you can do with those things. And that's the problem we have is that when we have all these monitors, and we don't know where the legs are. You know, because all we use is
keep the legs. Yeah, they're with the box. Where's the box?
The two things we can't find are the legs and the power supplies, because we don't buy monitors anymore that don't do figure eight or C13. And so and then we don't keep the legs. And so there's all these monitors and you can't find any power supplies or any legs because we're just like, well, you can just go anywhere and buy a figure eight.
I have a three monitor set up at home. I'd love to have it all in arms.
It is the way to go.
Lift it up, clean my desk, put it back down.
They make a lot of those.
I might do that.
Yeah, there's one company that I think still has a video of me reviewing it on like 5 years ago on their website. I can't think of their name right now, but that has like the really shiny, nice ones.
Yeah.
And then, but we buy a lot of cheap Amazon ones that are.
If you're Dwayne Johnson, you could just put like a GorillaPod at the back of the iMac and just carry it around like a selfie cam.
Let's take a break. When we come back, there is a lot more to talk about. You mentioned folding. I think we should talk a little bit about the rumors that Apple has a patent for a folding phone, and apparently Gorilla Glass or Corning is working on some sort of glass that will fold. Apple apparently doesn't want to do a plastic folding phone. Maybe there'll be a folding iMac. Who knows? Our show today brought... it's possible, right? It'd be a lot of folds. It'd be like a map. Our show today brought to you by this little doohickey. I love my Eero. Eero knows that the single router model that we grew up with Wi-Fi is broken today because we have so many devices. The bandwidth is congested now. We live in a high bandwidth world, so you need to go mesh. It's simple physics. Like white waves, Wi-Fi waves don't go through walls well. You wouldn't want a light bulb in your living room to light your master bedroom. What you need is a distributed system. In fact, for years, businesses have done it this way, but usually you need an IT professional to configure it and keep it running. Eero gives you an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home, and it's so easy to use. The Eero app will literally walk you through the process, iOS or Android. Once you've set it up, though, you'll continue to use the Eero app because it lets you manage the network from the palm of your hand. I can do it from right here. Not only my network, but my mom has Eero. I set her up with Eero. I can manage her network. You'll know how many devices are connected to any given point, the internet speed you're getting from your service provider. And with Eero Plus, you can do so much more. It's a simple design, reliable security system that defends your devices against a growing number of threats, malware, spyware, phishing attacks, and of course, unsuitable content. If you've got kids in the home, you're going to love Eero Plus. Eero plus Eero Plus provides complete protection for your network, your devices, and everybody who uses them as they connect to the internet. Block malicious and unwanted content across the entire network. By checking your sites you visit against a database of millions of known threats, Eero Plus prevents you from going to malicious sites by accident, and yet it doesn't slow you down. Plus, Eero Plus automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content. So you could choose what your kids can and cannot visit right in the Eero app. I am a happy Eero Plus subscriber, always have been. Not required to use Eero. It's nice to have that as a feature. Eero takes the problematic Wi-Fi. The shout I used to hear in the house is, honey, the Wi-Fi's down. I haven't heard that lately. Thank you, Eero. I really, really appreciate it. And if and you know as your needs grow, you can grow your Eero system. It starts with the Eero base unit. Connect that to your cable modem or your DSL modem, and then extend it with beacons. And you can add more beacons to extend it even farther. As I got cameras, you know, security cameras outside the house, I actually got an Eero beacon for the garage, so I can make the Wi-Fi easier for those external devices to reach. It's really great. WPA2 encryption, and really important, very important, constant firmware updates. Eero keeps on top of security, so your router is never out of date, never insecure. And they say that they'll be able to do firmware upgrades to WPA3, the next generation of encryption too, which is awesome. Eero updates automatically. You don't have to go out and check to see if there's a new firmware. It does it automatically. And it does it frequently. I mean, I don't know, but I see new Eero firmware versions every few weeks. And if you ever have a question, they have amazing customer support. You can call and get a Wi-Fi expert instantly within 30 seconds. And I've used it. And I made up a pretext because I've never had a problem with my Eero. And they were great. They stayed online with me through a fairly complicated port forwarding question until everything worked. I was so impressed. Never think about Wi-Fi again. We're going to get you a great deal, $100 off the base unit. But the package comes with the base unit and two beacons and a year of Eero Plus. You get $100 off when you go to Eero.com/MacBreak and use the code MacBreak at checkout. If you've been suffering with Wi-Fi, it's time to get Eero, Eero.com/MacBreak. Use the code MacBreak at checkout to get $100 off the Eero kit. You're going to want this. It is truly awesome. Thank you, Eero. So, patent filing. I don't put much stock in patent filings, but a patent filing for a folding phone. But one of the issues with folding phones is all of the folding screens from Samsung, TCL, Huawei are polymers. They're plastic. And there's a real concern about wear and creasing. And I have a feeling, you know, 6 months in, we're going to see these multi-thousand-dollar phones with ugly lines down the middle and all sorts of things.
Yep.
Apparently, Apple's looking
at... You think that crease is bad now.
Yeah, exactly. Apple's looking at glass. And the folks at Corning, who make Gorilla Glass, make Apple's glass for their iPhones, said, yeah, this is a tough physics problem, but we are working on flexible glass. They call it Willow Glass, that can bend and still be durable, reliable, and not have the problems polymers.
I am really excited about this and really ready to let it spend about a couple of years.
That's exactly what you're doing. That's the good news is lowered expectations, the Corning CEO said, and it's going to be a couple of years at least.
Well, even a couple of years after they release it. I want to see what this phone looks like. Same with the Samsung phone. I want to see what it looks like a year in or a year and a half in, because I don't know if that's really going to work.
Not only that, but things like time. It's February or March, and you've been home for about an hour. So, oh, that's right. I left my phone like in its holder in the car, and you're feeling, and it's really, really cold. You know what? Maybe I don't want to fold this until it gets back up to like 60 degrees, because it folds nicely in Southern California any time of the year, but.
Oh, that's a good. I never even thought of that. Yet.
Like, if you look at the Willow Glass, it's bending a little, but it's not folding flat the way the plastic does or a book.
So
does.
We're talking about an Audi, yeah,
yeah,
an Audi screen,
yeah.
And I get it. I mean, I think that they're going to sell enough of them because there's enough people like me that would buy them just for the conversation piece. If I didn't already have a hydrogen, that's my conversation piece. I don't need that.
Yeah, I'll tell
What's
you.
What's that conversation
weather?
Like?
Oh, it's great.
What's wrong with you? Why do you have that phone?
It's
the 3D photos are amazing.
Okay,
I'll show you some.
I've seen them.
I got better ones now. So anyway, okay. I've been shooting with it a lot. Well, I now have two because, you know, I bought the titanium, so they sent me a free aluminum one because the titanium one was late. So now I have
That's
two of them
nice.
Around.
And,
so you
and,
put them in a you put them in a case and you've got a foldable foldable hydrogen.
There you go.
Exactly. No, it's so the thing is that it's a fun piece to, you know, kind of chit chat about. So I get it, but as an operational phone, I think it's a horrible
idea. I can see the value. I can see why people are interested in folding phones, because imagine a phone that's not much bigger than your existing phone, but when it unfolds, you have a nice seven. You have an iPad mini, in effect.
I just don't know how it survives. Like, I just...
No, I agree with
you. Physics part
of
it in my head.
Huge about wear. No, I know.
If I only wanted it for a couple of weeks or a couple months to show off...
It works fine on Westworld. I don't know what you guys are worried about.
But also don't get fixated on phones. Like, imagine how cool it would be to have, like, a conventional, like, 13-inch MacBook that you can actually fold and actually make it purse size or even back pocket size. Imagine having an iPad that works that way. It would be... imagine again having the full flexibility, so to speak, of a large screen device for your first, for your whole day, for all day work, but not having to put it into a big laptop bag, being able to put it into a purse or just a little satchel.
Flexibility excites me a lot. Folding, not so much. You know, I'd love to have, you know, if I was working, I would love to have an arm like a Thor, like, you know, or like a.
Who's making one? It's like a slap bracelet phone.
Well, like I think of it as like a quarterback on playing NFL. Like, it's 6 inches long and it's on there. If I was working, that would be amazing to be able to just be able to look down and do something and walk away.
It's pretty clear from World Congress last week that we're going to see all kinds of crazy form factors as companies desperately try to find a way to get people to buy new phones.
Right.
And I don't think Apple's going to ever be the first to do a foldable phone. They like you, are waiting years to see what the long term.
That's all they do. All Apple does is they draft on everybody else. Right. They watch it, and then they pick a. Oftentimes, you know, the watches were out for a long time.
Do
before
we
Apple
agree that the folding phone is a good idea? Even do we even agree on that?
I'm not sure.
I think it's super interesting.
It is
interesting.
A compelling
we're
idea
find out.
That has not yet been implemented. Sorry.
Yeah, implementation is the key.
No, it looks like Renee and I are saying the same thing. Exactly, it's a super interesting idea. Really, I'm glad that Huawei is making one. I'm glad that Samsung is making one, because over the next year, just like with Google Glass, just like with so many other early products, we will find out what's good, what we like about it, what we can absolutely leave behind. And at $2,500, it's not as though the majority – this is a problem that most people are going to have to deal with. But again, the idea of having the convenience of larger screens and being able to make them portable, that so you don't have to make those sacrifices that you always have to make. Or even that device that you've got in front of you right now, Leo. Imagine the ability to have a device that to basically – travel with something that's like an 11 by 17 sheet of paper, but when you get to work, you really do have that big screen device. All these sort of things that could become possible, especially given if you're already spending $3,000 for this level of processing power, if that were like a $600 premium, and imagine a future in which these things are absolutely durable and you will not get like a decrease in contrast or a decrease in saturation at the point of flex. That could be really interesting.
I actually think that one of the things Samsung's done with Galaxy phones that nobody talks about that's very interesting is this DeX capability. I'll be getting the S10, but I have a Note 9. I'll get the S10 in a couple of days, 10 plus. And by the way, you can buy a Samsung DeX dock, but it turns out it's a standard. So for $20 on Amazon, I bought just a little dongle. You plug it in, and then it has an HDMI port. You plug in a monitor. It has a USB port, keyboard, and mouse. And if you have a 27-inch monitor, you just leave it at work and bring your phone around, and that's got all the data. And since I did buy the 1 terabyte version of the Galaxy S10, it really is a computer, right? It's got it's
12 gigabytes of RAM.
It's 12 gigs of RAM, terabyte of storage, Qualcomm 8 Snapdragon 855. That's pretty close to a desktop computer. It's certainly as fast as my MacBook Air.
Well, definitely for business applications, I think it
that might
makes
be a great way
sense,
to do it. Yeah.
Anyway. Especially given imagine a Chromebook in a pocket size form factor. Right. If all you have is a really good studly,
that's basically what it is.
Compliance. Yeah. And that's definitely the space that Samsung has pegged out for itself, where they're not really necessarily saying that you've got like the next generation features that you've got in an iPhone. Maybe not the sort of style of an iPhone, but there's people out there that really want the most powerful phone you can possibly get, because they're actually going to use all the power that's in there. Those are the people who want a terabyte of storage. They want an SD card slot. They want to have a screen.
Headphone jack.
Exactly. but that's their signature, and that's what they're really marking about.
I'm glad somebody's out there doing that. And by the way, they sell more phones than Apple does.
Well, and I think that for a lot of these folks, a lot of the platforms, including Apple, one of the things I think they don't do enough of is empower developers to push the envelope of their hardware.
Well, you made an interesting point, because you said that DeX is great for business apps, and it's exactly right. There's no Final Cut. There's no Logic. There's no Pro apps on that.
Well, but even for business apps, really pushing what happens is there's this kind of chicken or egg.
Microsoft Office on it.
Right, but there's a chicken or egg thing where, you know, you when you develop apps for business, you dumb them down because you think everyone's going to have a crappy computer. And then, you know, they come out with new technology. And the problem is that you aren't pushing the envelope of that hardware, doing the next cool things that could be done for those computers. You know, the iPhone and even this iPad can do so much that we aren't using. And you see it every once in a while. You open up some app that has all this 3D built into it and it runs seamlessly and you go, oh, that's what everything should look like. But these, you know, Apple and all the other companies, I don't think are investing enough in training their developers, building the right libraries, you know, building examples that really help push people to use it. You know, like for instance, right now, you know, Keynote is great. It's what everybody uses for presentations in my world, you know, when you're doing actual presentations in front of large numbers of people, but it's still 2D. Like there's no, and Apple has USDZ. But everything in Keynote is all a 2D animation. There's no 3D space, you know, sitting inside of it. And that kind of thing.
Apple should do that in-house?
Well, I think that there's two things. I think one is that pushing their own applications, their own business applications, you know, and adding those things into it. I think we're going to see that. I think that we'll see a new Apple, you know, the new iWork or whatever they call it now, stuff. I think we're going to see USDZ being added to it. And that's going to help kind of push people along, like, oh, I can add 3D to all of this. I do think that Apple should buy or build their own little kind of 3D development app.
I think Apple might have painted themselves into a corner because...
A thermal corner?
Well, they did that, we know, with the Mac Pro. But no, I mean, there's still a niche product. So developers aren't attracted to it in the numbers that they are to, say, Windows or even Android or iOS. And so the Mac OS doesn't get that kind of software.
Well, I'm not talking about Mac. I'm talking about iOS.
Oh, okay.
I
mean, you know, well, iOS is definitely a predominant platform.
I mean. Yeah, and iOS, the
there's
stuff...
There's a ton of iOS developers. Why do you think they're not doing the latest, greatest stuff?
It's because they don't... It's expensive to push the envelope. And I think that, you know, and other companies do, I think, invest more than Apple does. Apple kind of says, okay, we're going to build this great platform for you, and then they just expect everyone to jump on it.
It feels like they have a lot of... I mean, they offer, you know, Xcode for free, a very nice development environment. It seems like they have a lot of resources for developers. They work pretty hard to reach out.
I don't think anybody does a great job of educating developers on an everyday basis. You have a big conference. You have Google I/O and you have F8 and you have WWC, and then you have, you know, great tools. But this is something that I think
You
should be engaging.
Yeah.
You should be engaging folks every day,
especially young people.
Every week, every day,
because they're naturally going to want to develop for iOS anyway.
Right.
So now. Teach them to use the latest.
But not even just young people, but anybody who, like, the big thing is that we have this huge gap of,
I mean, they made Swift. Isn't that part of why they made Swift?
It's part of it. I think that there's still a huge gap between, and we talked about this on another show, but between Shortcuts and Swift, there is a kind of a
middle ground.
A middle ground of where I think something like a nodal composite, a nodal programming interface that is easy for the average person. And stop thinking about it being, they have to be computer science folks, but really, they have a problem they want to solve at home, that they want to solve in business, and they're going to develop it visually and then push it out. And I think that those are some of the ways that I know that with Quartz Composer, we pushed the envelope, the outer envelope of a Mac, because we could just do it. We could just draw a bunch of stuff and start stacking things up and building things that were kind of amazing without having to write a single line of code. You know, and I think that that's the...
So they let go of South Sequoia. I mean, they had, there was kind of an opportunity there with AppleScript and Automator. And
a little bit. I think that what I'm talking about is more graphics heavy, you know, yeah, stuff like that. Because that's what's going to push the hardware. It's not, you know, it's not the usability, but the hardware.
I'll tell you what, you got kids learning that right now. And that's how you learn most of these. I was watching on 60 Minutes, they did a piece on code.org and teaching kids. And it's all like that. It's all graphical drag and drop.
Exactly.
You know, coding. So they're used to that idea.
Because that's the hard part of understanding how do you set up all the commands so that they're all going to do what they need to do. Once you figure that out, then you go, okay, what is the snippet of code that does that thing? And then you start typing it in. Yep. But it's hard to learn both of those at the same time.
Yep.
Yeah, Apple, as long as you keep the focus, as long as you just keep the focus on here's what you want to make, and we're going to teach you how to make that thing that you want to make as opposed to pretending that computer science in itself is a fascinating field of discovery for kids.
Right. It is.
Right.
Think it is. But no, I know what you're saying. It's a harder sell than saying, oh, but look what you could do.
Or solution-driven engineering is something that the problem you get into with the people who are just engineers, not just engineers, but engineers, is they can get very caught up in the technology of it, of how to do it.
Yeah.
You dig into it and you're just like,
we think it's super cool.
I want to add this button because I want to add this button rather than I'm trying to solve a problem.
Well, and you get a certain category of software as a result. Same reason you need diversity because otherwise it's all, you know, these white men, you know, who have a certain mindset and everything, software reflects the culture that created it.
Right.
All I'll say is that my proficiency in programming, my interest in technology is largely, I owe a great debt to Electronic Arts for putting such great copy protection on their games when I was a kid.
The reason why
I learned how to code, I went from basic to assembly language was there's got to be a way to copy this game.
That's how I learned how to use a hex editor. one of our sponsors last year, or maybe the year before, was a really cool security camera called Lighthouse. Sad to say, Lighthouse is now defunct. They had a camera that used time of flight, LIDAR, night vision, and a lot of AI. It was an Andy Rubin investment, and they had some really smart people from the ARPA Grand Challenge and elsewhere to do this AI. I used it. In fact, I wish I could still use it, but the servers have been turned off. What we didn't know when they... And by the way, they paid everybody back who bought a Lighthouse, which I'm grateful to because I would have felt very guilty pushing that product and people then couldn't use it anymore. But fortunately, everybody got theirs bought back. What we didn't know is in December, Apple bought all their patents, including the AI patents, including the time of flight sensor patents, computer vision-based security system using a depth camera, method and system for visual authentication, method and system for using light emission by a depth sensing camera to capture video images under low light conditions, speech interference for vision-based monitoring system, two-way communication interface. I think that should be speech interface, not interference. Two-way communication. I'm reading this from 9 to 5 Mac. That must be a typo. Two-way communication interface for vision-based monitoring system. These are all patents, Lighthouse patents, that Apple has acquired, which I think is really cool.
Yes.
Maybe a HomePod with a camera?
Anything that you want. Because right now you can do Face ID up to about, I forget what, 15 centimeters or some. It's got a very small depth of face. But once you, and they've already got plans to put the lasers on the back cameras. And whether it's, you know, it's not really across the room Face ID, but it's across the room object identification that Alex has talked about before, we talked about earlier with the cars. You start to be able to not only define the exact parameters of your environment, but the objects within it. And you're basically teaching the computer to not just see a photo, but to understand everything that's in the photo. Not like humans do, but in a way that makes sense to computers and all the
really
other
well.
Stuff you want inside it.
I could look at my Lighthouse and I could say, hey, let me know when Lisa gets home and let me know where the cats are. And it knew. I mean, and they weren't close. It knew it across the room. Oh, there's a cat. There's a dog. There's Lisa. There's the kids. It knew. It was great.
And a lot of these technologies can identify you by your gait, by the way you stand. If you think about when you see one of your friends 100 feet away, then they are essentially a couple pixels for you, and you know, oh, that's Frank, or oh, that's whatever, because of something that they're doing that is
Frankish.
That
only Frank would do that.
Only Frank does that, you know? and so... But you notice that, well, they're starting to get, a lot of the AI is starting to get good enough where it knows who you are and also what your next behaviors may be based on, you know, just the movement of your body. And a lot of the LIDAR stuff, the time of flight stuff, is important to figure that out.
Very cool. The U.S. government is imposing new restrictions on shipping charged batteries. This is not for you getting on a plane, but it will mean your next iPhone will not have a half full or even 30% full battery.
Saw that with the battery cases. They all shipped empty.
Yeah. 30. Yeah. I just got a wireless thing for the HTC Vive. It was dead. I thought, I can't use it. I got to charge it up. It took a long time to charge it up. I was so bummed. Batteries, lithium-ion batteries can be charged to no more than 30%.
And this is also, for folks like me that do production, this is a pain. You know, like it's
I don't know if they're going to change whether you get on the plane, but it is going to change when you buy something.
Well, it's you know, it's not so much when we ship a lot of like hardware, and so in that hardware, the batteries are too big for us to just put in our carry on,
right?
And so you know, they're UPS batteries and stuff like that, and we have big signs on them of exactly what kind, and we flip them, and there's a whole bunch of things that you do, and you drain them out and stuff like that. But we do things that are safety conscious, but it does. I get the risk of doing that. So I understand where they're coming from. And a lot of the airlines have already made this against the rules. So I just got rid of my Away. I have an Away bag, and I just got rid of the battery because it's just too much trouble to deal with.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I didn't realize this, but Apple was one of the first companies to ship fully charged or mostly charged products. Before, I do remember that before then, it was routinely that they would come uncharged.
Right.
And Tony Fadell actually talked about this at a TED conference in 2015. He said, I learned from Steve Jobs that you have to think about the consumer who's never experienced your product before. And Jobs insisted designers think about what it would be like to open a new device with a dead battery. It's a bad first impression. He talked about shipping a product with a charged battery, and only a few years ago it was all too common to unwrap a new MP3 player with the glee of Christmas morning, only to find out we had to wait a few hours to charge the device. Now Apple products come at least partially charged. Well, 30% will be the max, but that's not Apple's fault.
Yes, remember, it's important to get that initial dopamine hit right away. the sooner they set that up, the sooner they could be buying apps.
That's a good point. That's a big Christmas day and New Year's Day. Big days for buying apps.
User is happy.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's reasonable, and it did make a big difference. Yeah. It's a minor thing, but I'm sad to see that won't be the case anymore. Yeah. Apple. We talked last week or a couple of weeks ago about Apple getting a little heat on their shot on iPhone campaign. Because they didn't explicitly say they would pay for the photos. They later said, no, we will. Of course we will. We didn't think anybody would think about that. The pictures have been selected. The 10 winners will be featured on billboards in select cities. The judges included Obama photographer Pete Souza, Phil Schiller. I guess he's a pretty avid amateur photographer. And others. Here are some of the winners. This is a beautiful picture of architectural picture. It must be Miami, right? Where else could it be?
No, I think that's international. There's a huge international spread here, which I think is excellent.
Here is a shot that Phil Schiller particularly liked. Let me squinch it down a little bit of a raccoon looking down a log. And of course, one of the reasons they pick them is because they're beautiful shots. But the other one is they're shot on iPhone and they show off iPhone features. In this case, HDR. Schiller says it's a nice use of black and white, and it couldn't have happened. Actually, it was Austin Mann who said this image took a lot of patience, great timing, and with the iPhone zero shutter lag and smart HDR, we're able to see both the raccoon's eyes and the deep shadows inside the log. That's actually a really good point. That would be a hard shot to get without HDR because you got to figure the raccoon's got a lot of light around him. The log is very dim and dark, but it really is a great shot.
Yeah, I bet a lot of these weren't even manipulated a lot on desktop apps. I bet that these were close to straight out of the camera. I'd love it if they mentioned that, but I would not be surprised if these were just a few sliders in the actual Photos app, if anything.
Yeah. I'll show you my favorite, which is a puddle reflection.
Yeah, it's so good.
Isn't that good? Yeah. It's a heart-shaped puddle. And this is the kind of thing that it's really serendipity. Unless you're sitting there for hours waiting for somebody to walk across just right, which I doubt.
Well,
you just happen to get
there. Then you realize it's upside down.
Right. That's the key. In fact, can you flip that, Carsten? I don't know if you're able to do it, but if you turn this upside down, you'll see the actual as shot. Look at this. This guy has all the tools. Now it makes more sense, right? That at the top is the woman walking, and then her reflection's in the puddle. But the photographer is brilliant.
Can I tell you that the most encouraging thing for anybody who wants to be a really good photographer is when you get to see the contact sheets of every single like iconic image. Henri Cartier-Bresson, who has these beautiful like slice of life moments, you say, oh, he really, really did just stand there in front on the top of that staircase waiting for the exact right combination of people to happen to walk by.
It takes have a good previs, the ability to pre-visualize what's going to happen. A lot of patience.
And a lot of photos.
Magnum, at one point, Magnum did a photo show that toured around that had it's a photo agency, some of the most famous iconic pictures ever on the contact sheets. And it was great to see these iconic, Yoko and John iconic picture with all of the much less iconic images. Yeah. You're right, Andy. That's a real eye opener. And it's encouraging for any photographer to see that, We only see the cake that's perfect, not the one that was left out on the ledge. Anyway, beautiful shots. If you go to Apple's newsroom, you can see all of the 10 winners. Some black and white, some color. All amazing if you think about it. This was done with a camera phone.
Right.
I mean, holy cow.
Well, I think that in the 60 Minutes thing, they listed that I believe there's 200 engineers, at least there were a couple years ago, 200 engineers just working on the phone camera.
Yeah.
Just making sure that camera is getting the most out of the physics of it. They've got a lot of large staff.
I think Apple's smart too, because you might say, the Pixel 3 has technically a better camera, the Galaxy 10 is technically a better camera. Apple's smart to emphasize the art, the emotion, the feeling.
The
because
results, yeah.
Honestly, maybe you get better night sight on a Pixel 3 XL, but I've never seen better shots than I've seen on the iPhone. For somehow, there's something about it. It just is able to get these incredible shots.
And this is why reviews that go to like these real pixel peeping sort of, hey, we've magnified this 1,000% so you can see the grain, really misses the point. It's not just the quality of the JPEG that you're getting out of the phone. It's also how fast was this thing able to take that picture? When you suddenly saw your kid doing something adorable, and how fast was it between getting the phone out of your pocket to getting the camera app in front of the screen to stabbing your phone on top of that circle and getting the picture? Was there any sort of a lag? Was there any sort of a pause or a delay? Did it give you a feature where you just held your thumb down on that thing and it took a million photos in 1 second and then pointed out the three that were actually very, very good? These are the things that the iPhones do exceptionally well. And that's why it will always be at the very, very top of basically tied for first place amongst two or three people. It's just these little things that make it into a great, great, great camera.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's take a break. Your picks, folks, prepare them as I tell you about my pick for a VPN. I know more and more people are aware of the value of a VPN for protecting your privacy, for protecting your security. And the real challenge is you go out there, if you Google VPNs, there's thousands of them. And the vast majority of them, and don't be tempted because they're really low price or cheap, but the vast majority of these are junk. They're not protecting your privacy or security. There's some of them insert ads into your stream. You need a good company, a company that protects you by not logging your activity. ExpressVPN is it. Number one on Tech Radar. That's votes from actual users. It comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's not the cheapest VPN out there, and I know that. And you don't want it to be because, honestly, it's expensive to run all the servers that they run and make sure they all have enough bandwidth so that the VPN doesn't slow you down. That is not something you can do inexpensively. So any VPN that's free or cheap, they're making money on you somehow, or their service is going to be terrible. ExpressVPN is awesome. Less than $7 a month, you get the same ExpressVPN protection I use every day. It is fantastic. They are not owned in the United States, so that's good too. I think there's some people who are looking for that. But they do have servers all over the world, and that means you also can get around, if you're worried about that, you can get around what we call geographic restrictions. It's very, very handy to be able to emerge in the UK or in Singapore if you want to watch content on TV from those countries, for instance. Plus, it's encrypting everything. So the guy in the hoodie in the coffee shop next door is not going to be able to see what you're doing. It's easy to use on every platform. They have apps for Mac, Windows, iOS, and Android. And these apps are easy to use. They run seamlessly in the background. One click turn on, one click turn off. So when you say, oh, I think I'm going to be safe right now, that guy looks a little shady, boom, you are. ExpressVPN lets you safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having your data stolen or hacked. And I know a lot of people use ExpressVPN even at home because they don't want their internet service providers snooping on them. Protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 extra months free when you buy a 1-year package. That's the best deal out there. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. And I was reading a news story. Where was it? Maybe it was Turkey. The government seized ExpressVPN servers because they were trying to track down a dissident. There was nothing on them. They couldn't do anything with it. So if you, a lot of companies might say, well, we protect your privacy. We don't log. But we got proof. ExpressVPN does not keep track of what you're up to. It's a good company. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. Andy, your pick of the week.
Hopefully a fun one for people. I decided that I needed to have a Rubik's Cube after being a kid of the 80s. And largely I bought it because I was just curious about them. And then I found out that these are just such good fidget devices. And if you have, if you buy a modern one where they round off some of the corners in there, you can really just play with this in one hand all day long. My part one of my two-part pick of the week is the DFantix Moyu Weilong GTS version 2 3x3 speed cube. Apparently you have to call this a speed cube and not a Rubik's Cube if it's not actually made by the fine people at Rubik's Cube. And it's, again, just such a fun thing to it is like my favorite fidget at the moment. It is always on my desk, or I've actually been playing with it this entire show.
I hope you bought the Maru Lube Speed Cube Lubrication.
I'm not going to make that joke. It's
it's high quality lube for your puzzle cube.
I saw Spider-Man Noir playing with one in the movie, and I just had to have one.
You have a Rubik's. This is the funniest recommendation ever.
Yeah,
who doesn't have a Rubik's cube?
I don't have I do in my
the ones that I have trouble with are the 4x4s. I don't know what it
those
is about the 4x4. Not 2x2, 4x4.
Oh,
it's got an extra round. It's got an extra row, and for some reason, my brain is like, I cannot do this.
You'll see there on YouTube, there are people who made these really weirdo 20x20 cubes, 40x40 cubes, where they have to make these things.
Colors on the six just to mess with people. Yeah.
It's weird, but the Mac and Apple sort of twist of this is that a really great app on the iPhone called Magic Cube Solver. There are now really perfect algorithms for how to solve cubes in 22 moves or less. So if you want to suddenly have this restored back to where it was before, you can basically show it what this – I don't believe it uses the camera, but you can easily show it what they program in, what your cube looks like, and it will give you turn-by-turn directions, like GPS. But the other cool thing about this that separates it from a lot of other cube solvers is that it will actually teach you what the algorithm is. So if you want to learn how to do this instead of just always having to turn to the app, it will coach you on why you need to make the moves that you're trying to make. Right now, I'm just playing with it as a fidget, but I kind of just, I'm looking forward to at one point being able to solve these things. So it does, as you see, it will solve the 4x4 cubes, the 2x2 cubes. There are other apps that will do, like, for if you're trying to do a speed challenge, that's why I guess that's why they're calling them speed cubes now, because there are people who are trying to do it in less than 18 seconds, less than 10 seconds. There's a blindfolded record, there's a one-handed record, but again, this isn't just simple nostalgia. I think it's an interesting mathematical theoretical device, and the fact that I like to play with it like a toy.
I think in grade school I got under 30 seconds, but I can't remember it now. Yeah. Any 3x3.
Wow.
4x4 now. Yeah. No, I can't do that.
When I was in school, I solved it once, and that was largely by dumb luck, and I was so excited that I had to buy another cube because I didn't want to mess up the one that I solved.
Do they come solved?
Nope, they come solved, and okay. Eventually you play with it and it becomes like this. Yeah. But there are a bunch of really nice apps. If you want to experiment with other apps, that's fine too, because they all do things. It's fun when you watch it. It'll quickly get a 22 move solution, because mathematically it will never take more than 22 moves to solve a cube. But then you'll see on other apps I have, you see it will continue to grind and try to brute force it. Oh, I found a 19 move one. Oh, found a 16 move one. And you kind of like, I know that I'm not connected to AC power, but I really want to see this. I really want to run down this entire battery trying to see if it can, how small and efficient a solution it can actually make.
Have you seen the world's fastest Rubik's Cube solver made from Lego, Mindstorms?
Oh, God, I've seen that one. Yeah.
See, 2 seconds.
See, automation is going to take away so many jobs.
This is not
all those professional machines, Rubik's Andy. Cube solvers are now screwed.
It starts with this and ends up with the Matrix. Funny.
That'd be kind of fun code to write, the code to solve Rubik's Cubes.
Yeah. No, because I'm picking this one, this app, because I think it's the nicest combination of features. But there are other ones, like there's an Android app that I have that is really nice, and that you literally just show it. It will use the camera to just dice, to basically analyze the cube, and then from there actually go on its own. And you can watch there's like all kinds of mathematical videos explaining principles about it. Really, I honest to God, I bought this because I had like a whole bunch of Amazon like gift credits from Black Friday that came in last month, and I like to spend those credits on like fun things. I said, oh wow, Rubik's Cube, haven't had one of those before, I'll get one of these. And now it's like it's at least 5% of what I'm thinking about over the course of any given week. It is quite addictive, and no batteries required.
Alex, how about a pick from you, sir?
I got some new headphones.
Getting my wallet ready.
Uh-oh.
So I got these.
These
are actually just getting released today, I think.
Oh.
They sent them to me to take a look at.
They must be so good.
They're pretty nifty. This is a Surge 3D. And so they've got kind of a pseudo 7.1 surround sound.
This was an Indiegogo.
Indiegogo. And they are right now, I think for the next month, they're like $89 or something like that. And they're amazing, you know, at that price. And I think that, you know, basically they have this kind of, it really is the most immersive that I've put, headphones I put on to watch movies. That's how I tested it. I put it on and I watched Live, Die, Repeat, or Dead, Die, Live, Repeat, or whatever that that surround sound happens to be really good, and I happen to know it because I've got a system in my house, and so it's one of the ones that I kind of tested on that and Saving Private Ryan, and it just really feels. I suddenly realized how much I was losing on the plane listening with my AirPods, you know, just watching movies. it feels like it's all around you. And one of the things that they added, I thought that was actually pretty useful. They've got wired, it's got Bluetooth, and they also have a little noise canceling microphone that you can attach to it, but you don't have to keep it on there. And what's nice about that is you don't have to take it out and take off your headphones to answer the phone. You can simply if a phone call comes in, you can actually answer the phone with it. I don't think that the audio, I tested it. I called some friends. I called my Uber tester, Fred, if you're listening. And we all decided that it's not as good as the AirPods as far as the quality of the audio, but it's still much better than me having to put nice over the head, over the ear headphones on, and then have to change them out when I want to talk on the phone. And it worked perfectly for me. And so anyway, so I don't think you can find better headphones at $89 than these ones. I think that I'd probably be more tempted to listen to these than my Bose. So so they're really, really good value right now. And it's just a really, really good sound. And I haven't had over the, I admit, I don't use the, I have in-ear almost all the time because I don't like to travel with over the, I don't like to use up the space in my backpack. But I'm actually now taking these along on flights because I suddenly realized what I was missing. I was like, oh, it is a lot nicer when they're over your ears. And again, you can also control the movie with the headphones. So if you have it sitting out there, you can tap on it and you can answer for calls and other things with the a little bit more control than you actually have on your AirPods. So it's a slick headset. Again, I think it's an incredible value right now. So if you're interested in over the head, they're really into the cushion. It is very comfortable. I had it on for hours and didn't realize that, just forgot that they were on and just kind of was doing my thing and suddenly realized I had headphones on.
Their Indiegogo started today, it looks like.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Can I tell you how much I agree with you on that point, where there was a rare time when I was on a train and I decided to just toss my regular headphones like in a bag, and only then did I realize that, wow, I keep wearing these earphones for convenience, but my goodness, the sound, the music is so much nicer, and the movies are so much nicer, and I don't have to, like, after 2 hours, I don't have to, like, unplug one ear and give it a rest because it's starting to, like, sort of nudge on me. Yeah. And so that's what finally got me to buy, like, one of these hard cases for my headphones, because I want to now have the option of taking these. I had no idea how much joy I was denying myself by not taking like real headphones with me when I travel.
Yeah. No, it's definitely something that I haven't had it for a long time. You know, I kept on buying Bose and losing them somewhere, and then I didn't like to pack them and everything else, and so I was being too utilitarian. And when I saw these go by, I pinged them, and they sent me some, and and I suddenly realized, oh my goodness, I am going to use these a lot.
Like to see an Indiegogo where they actually have made some, as opposed to Indiegogos I've invested in where they never did make any.
Yeah, they made them, and they work.
Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week, my friend.
Yeah, so my pick of the week is something that I've been wanting to do for a while, and that was to take my YouTube videos from 16:9 to 2:1, because that better suits the aspect ratio of iPhone 10, Galaxy S. You know, all the new flagship phones are big and tall. Sony is ridiculously so now. But the 16:9 were just putting too much pillar box on the side. So I wasn't sure how to do it. I asked Jonathan Morrison, who's a really well-known, really beautiful YouTuber, makes absolutely gorgeous videos, and he convinced Marques Brownlee to do it. So I asked his advice. I've been working on it for a while. I finally have a workflow that I really liked, and I was starting to get asked about it. So I decided to make a tutorial that shows how you get your footage in, how I still shoot in 16:9 because I want the extra pixels. I don't want to throw them away, but this shows you how to get the 2:1 project, how to fill it out so that you don't have the pillar boxes, how to adjust it if you need to, how to deal with legacy plugins that aren't shaped for 2:1 that are still 16:9. So they stop short of the edges, different ways to fix those. And also just little tips. And Jonathan was nice enough to add some tips of his own towards the end of the video. So if you use Final Cut Pro and you're at all interested in 2:1, 2:1, 2:1 video, then this will walk you through the entire process from beginning to end.
I'm just so glad you're not talking about 1:2.
No, Alex. And shout out to Judd, who's there in that video. He does all the awesome video stuff at Apple.
We get that request, and you're just like, the only thing worse than 1:2 is 1:1.
Yeah. What is 1:2? What would that even look
it's
like?
It's not really 1:2. It's nine
like
by
Instagram.
It's not the, TV. The 9:16. It's like the vertical for Instagram and Snap and everything else. People want to do videos long.
I thought Instagram was square.
Here's what I would say is that it actually, if you're talking to, if you're just a talking head, it actually works better. I will admit, If you're just talking ahead, someone's going to watch that, look at their phone, and you're not
one
showing
by two
anything.
Is better.
A 1x2 is better.
Oh, that's vertical video, of course.
Yeah, vertical video is better when you're just a person talking to other people.
Sure.
It looks better. It's better for them. As soon as you want to show them anything, it becomes really not great. Anyway, that's great. I didn't think about that. Do you take into account the notch? Is that kind of like you think about what the dead space is?
So you block that. Like by default, it won't go to the notch. It stops just short of the notch with 2x1, which is what's nice about it. If you double tap, it will cut off a bit of the top and bottom. So I make sure to leave space for that and to make sure none of the lower thirds touch on that. And then I leave everything out of the size just in case. I mean, some people, I'm sure you can have fun with it, like patrol eyes or hair on it or something if you're smart enough. But I just avoid it entirely.
Actually, everybody's complaining about the hole punch on the Galaxy because
but the wallpapers are so good. It's like they put like minion goggles on it, and the wallpapers are amazing.
They're having fun. Actually, I saw one that took a sideways iPhone XS, and because that not the hole punch is about the same as the camera. So the wallpaper has at the top an iPhone with a hole punch where the camera would be. That's a problem if you're trying to watch video, play a game, or anything. That hole punch is a notch seems a little bit better actually than a hole punch in that regard.
We're just nothing's biding perfect time until we get the subscreen technology. Yeah.
So is everything in Vector now 2x1?
Yeah, it's all 2x1 now. I'm super happy with it. I mean, YouTube supports it natively. Final Cut Pro has native projects for it. There's just a couple workarounds. I said, like with the legacy plugins, if you know Motion, you can just edit them in Motion. Otherwise, you can make them a compound clip. But I've been very happy. And even Netflix, apparently Netflix is doing their new shows in 2x1, like Stranger Things, and it's just, I think it's going to catch on.
Oh, I did notice
that. It's like
that.
A sweet spot.
Yeah, I did know. I thought, that's kind of weird. On my TV, it's got bars, right? Because your TV is more like 2.5.
We get a lot of movies that are like 2.35, which 16, is even 9, more. Really. More one. Yeah. That's even more dramatic.
This is sort of like between 2.35 and 16:9.
Renee Ritchie's Vector is at imore.com/Vector. His writing's at imore. You must follow him. And, of course, that's where his article on how to make 2x1 with Final Cut Pro 10 is. Thank you, Renee, for being here. Really appreciate it. Always great to have you. Alex Lindsay, you can follow him on the Twitter. He's the man from the Pixel Corps, AlexLindsay. Anything coming up?
Nope.
And then...
other than me complaining about the Oscars, I think that was my... on Twitter.
Well, you saw that Steven Spielberg said, I don't think we should ever nominate anything that didn't show cinematically in a theater.
That's exactly what I was talking about.
He wanted to change the rules so that Roma could not have been nominated. And I think he's so wrong.
I think the bottom line is that most of the viable movies that for Oscars in 10 years are going to be all Netflix and everything else, because no one's going to make that kind of movie for big screens. Big screens are going to become events.
Spielberg says that's not movie, that's made for TV. That's because, of course, his first big movie was made for TV, but that's not the same. Made for TV back then is not the same as Netflix today.
Yeah, it would be an awful, awful thing if everybody who watches the Oscars had seen every single movie, including the documentary features that are nominated, because the last thing we want is for people to be actually have an emotional investment in who wins.
That's a very, very good point. Yeah.
The danger comes back to Hollywood. If Hollywood actually did that, the smart thing to do would be to create another awards.
The streamies.
And then I wouldn't take the ones that already exist. I'd just build one and redesign it for the online audience and recreate something. And within 10 years, again, it would be no one would be paying attention to the Oscars.
Well, this is where the Golden Globes has a little bit of an advantage because they do TV, they do movies, they do whatever they want.
Right.
I think it's actually a more representative. It's ridiculous to say, we'll only give an award to poetry written in blank verse. If it rhymes, well, we just can't.
If it's iambic pentameter, then
If it's not iambic pentameter, nothing.
Exactly.
And that's, that's just not. Art doesn't depend on the medium. Art is art.
Folks that are very connected to the old film school and the 2398 and all that other stuff is all, they're just hanging on as best they can.
I thought Roma was easily the most amazing movie of the year.
Oh, good.
Really loved Roma.
Haven't seen it yet.
It's shot, in fact, I was meaning to ask you about it. It's shot in digital black and white. They're using, Alexa 65 camera, which is an Arri digital camera.
Everybody uses the Alexa.
Yeah, camera.
Features,
I think, in fact, Stranger Things is shot on it. But The black and white is beautiful. The tonal range, the quality is amazing.
There's a milky,
it's HDR.
There's a milky kind of smoothness that the Alexa has that there's no other camera that I've shot on. My brother is an Alexa snob. Like, he will not. Like, he mostly does really high end work, and so he's just like, oh, he just uses Alexa. And I give him a hard time because I use my Blackmagic cameras and everything else. But I will admit that there is a in good lighting, I don't see much difference between my Blackmagic Mini Ursas and his, but in movie filmmaking. Oh yeah. So
you can't call it the Alyosha. It's a camera.
It's a camera. I'm not talking about
that. Sorry.
Anyway.
Sorry. What can I do? I can't help you.
So anyway, it's a gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous chip. They've taken over.
It's HDR black and white. This Roma. You got to watch it. It's on an HDR screen. It's incredible.
Yeah. What the HDR is basically what they're doing is they're shooting the whole thing in what's called log. You know, an ARRI log is the thing. You're shooting at log, which is a much wider gamut, and then you convert that to HDR later. Right. So and all films were kind of built that way. That's why all these old films can come out in HDR.
Right.
Is because they were all the film response was typically a log. Right. When it was scanned, it was a log response. And so that is the so there, you're just able to reconvert it back to PK 2020 and then into Dolby Vision or.
You were the guy to ask. Yeah. The other thing is Cuaron was his own DP. My guess is
DQ
he was
2020, by the way.
He was carrying the Alexa 65 and shooting it, so it's very cinema verite feeling. But he also does some very unusual framing. You want to see it.
I just haven't gotten my.
He's a great director.
Foreign films, I always have to kind of warm up to. Like,
I thought the same thing. and by the way, the first shot is 6 minutes long, and really slow, and it's going to irk you.
Well,
you're going to kind of get it.
Once I get into it, like my wife was watching the girl with the dragon tattoo, and I was like, oh, don't even, like the Swedish ones are so much better, and like don't even bother with the American versions because the Swedish ones. And she was like, I don't want to watch all the subtitles. And then
ones were better.
And the problem is they're no longer on Netflix, so you have to watch. You have to watch one on Vudu and another one on this. And you have to like bounce around finding, like, it's like this little.
They were truer to the book.
You have to go to Amazon Prime, and you have to subscribe to the horror thing for $2, and then watch it, and then immediately cancel it. You know, like just to watch the girl with the dragon tattoo. But they are infinitely better than. Than the American versions.
I agree. Watch it on a high quality. I watched it on my OLED HDR. Watch Roma, and on a high quality.
Oh, yeah.
I think you will really appreciate
it. Can't wait.
And it's why I completely disagree with Steven Spielberg. That movie was as artistic as any movie nominated this year.
It's rumored that they spent $150 million on promoting it to get the Oscars.
Roma? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what Spielberg didn't like.
That's what it is.
Yeah. That's what Spielberg didn't like. He said, these Aravist. You know, dot-commers, they got too much money.
I mean, it was seen as a bit gauche when Miramax spent $25 million promoting something. You know, now they're in a whole
Shakespeare
world.
In Love. Yes,
that's right. But that was a great movie. Deserved to win.
Wait until all the sports.
No, you didn't like Shakespeare in Love. I liked it.
Wait until all the sports contracts come up, and the Fang Group just takes them all. You know, like, you know, broadcasters can't compete now. Like,
they're out of their league. Yeah.
So the first one's the NFL in 2021.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Oh, that's interesting.
Popcorn, please.
Oh, that'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll be able to finally see Bob's Burgers at its appropriate time instead of 4 minutes delayed.
That's Andy Iannacco. Catch him Fridays, WGBH Boston, Boston Public Radio, and of course every Tuesday right here on Mac Break Weekly. Thank you guys for being here. We do Mac Break Weekly. We're going to enter finally in the United States. We're entering summertime on Sunday. So we normally shoot this show at around 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 1900 UTC, but starting next week, it'll be 1800 UTC. I think, if my math is correct. As we spring forward into daylight saving time, as we call it here.
Oh, God, I am so ready for it still to be light out at 5 or 6 p.m. Yeah. I'm so ready for this. This has been a very long winter.
It has been, especially for you back east and you in Montreal.
You know, we keep on having all these people talk about We keep on having people talk about like this whole like jobs and the Green Promise program, whatever, in Congress. And all I want to hear about is how we're going to abolish daylight savings.
Did that pass in California? It passed, right?
It opened the door to it. It
doesn't do anything, but it passed. Yeah. We're gonna change the clocks on Sunday. Don't forget, we'll be at a different time. I don't know what.
Spring forward.
We'll be an hour earlier.
They're taking an hour away from us.
Yes. Just make sure you watch YouTube. It has a live stream. Actually, the best thing to do is go to twit.tv/live, and you can choose your favorite live video or audio. We have two audio streams as well. Listen and watch. And if you do that, if you're doing it live, go to the chat room. They're live also, irc.twit.tv. That's the true conversation Alex was talking about. You can watch on demand, too, and pretend you're watching live. But that way it could fit into your busy life. And you can get our show at the website, twit.tv/mbw, audio or video. Best thing to do, we find your favorite podcast application and subscribe. We're everywhere because we're one of the, I don't want to say oldest podcasts in the world, one of the longest running in the world. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. But now you got to get back to work because break time is over.